Sangye Chö Tang Sogye Chö Nam Ma Jang Chö Bar Du Dag Mi Kya Su Chi Dagye Jin Sogye Bi So Nam Gi Dro La Pen Chö Sangye Dro Par Shu.
I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints. From the virtuous merits that I collect by the practice of giving and the other perfections, may I attain the state of a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings.
I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddhas, the Dharma, and the assembly of saints.
May all beings have happiness and the causes of happiness. May all beings be free from suffering and the causes of suffering.
May all beings never be separated from the bliss which is sorrowless.
May all dwell in equanimity, free from aversion and clinging. The ground is covered with flowers and sprinkled with scented water.
In the middle is Mount Mirror, surrounded by the four continents and ornamented by the sun and the moon.
By visualizing all this and offering it as a Buddha realm,
may all sentient beings partake of the Buddha's pure lands. Okay, welcome to Parting from the Four Attachments. This evening is a kind of a continuation of last week. We talked about calm abiding last week. This week we'll talk about special insight. And the main thing that Lama asked me to emphasize about this session is to talk about the difference between the mind-only school and the middle way school. So we'll be talking about that. Actually, the masters will be talking about that. But that's the main topic we're going to cover, special insight with the emphasis on the philosophical view of it. Special insight wisdom meditation has several steps to it. So the first step is to establish that all outer objects or outer appearances are created by the mind. And then the second step is to establish that all of those mental objects themselves are illusory. And then the third step is to establish all of those illusions as devoid of inherent nature. So that's kind of the outline of how the meditation itself goes. One of the important points in talking about this is to stay away from the extremes that one can fall into in these philosophical discussions, and to stay in what's called the middle way or the middle path. So not to go into nihilism, or some people say nihilism, but anyway, don't go there. And on the other end, don't go to eternalism. Nihilism meaning nothing exists, and eternalism meaning that things are permanent. And those two extremes are, at the extreme end, it's sort of easy to see that those are extremes, but it's a bit of a continuum, and one can drift in those directions, and it's important not to do that, but to stay in the middle way. The middle way does not mean that it's in the middle of a continuum. It's completely outside the continuum. Okay? So these are the philosophical topics that last week we said the curriculum lasts 50 years. So there's a lot to study there. But we'll give it our best shot tonight. So His Eminence Chogyi Trichen Rinpoche said, or he asked, why is it necessary to properly understand these things in order to realize the true nature of mind? And then he answered, well, without the correct view, even if one perseveres on the path, one will still go astray. For example, if one falls into the extreme positions known in the Buddhist tradition as eternalism and nihilism, one will not even be able to reach the levels of liberation attained by the hearers and the solitary awakened ones. Grasping at an eternal existence actually prevents us even from attaining rebirth in the higher realms. If you grasp at your own being as having a truly existing self, or if you fixate upon phenomena as having some truly existing identity, there is simply no way to gain liberation or enlightenment. Those who hold nihilistic positions or viewpoints believe in a null and void final absence of anything. One who persists in such errors has not the slightest chance of gaining a higher rebirth in samsara as a human or a god, let alone of attaining liberation from samsara. Thus, Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen is directing us to the ultimate truth, to the way that we can recognize and sustain our recognition of the true nature of our own mind. For this, it's first necessary that we do not trouble ourselves with the notions of eternalists and nihilists. The predicament they present needs to be invalidated and nullified. Once you have resolved this dilemma for yourself, you're free to abide in equanimity in the emptiness of all things. If we truly take to heart the teachings on parting the four attachments and meditate on its meaning, this will be very profound and will benefit us greatly. And Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen himself, in his Song of Experience, said, all phenomena are mind's sphere of experience. Do not see a creator in the four elements, in chance, in God, or the like. But be joyful in the nature of mind itself. Appearances are of the nature of magical illusions, and they arise through interdependence. Not knowing how to describe their natural state, be joyful in the ineffable, that is, the state of inexpressibility. That was Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen. And Sakya Pandita commented on Jetsun Drapa Gyaltsen, saying, up to this point, having shown the stages of the path common with the Bodhisattva mind-only school, now the uncommon path of the Mahayana Madhyamaka school will be explained. His Holiness the 41st Sakyatrizin said, if you begin to examine the mind through study, contemplation, and meditation, you will not find it. In the same way that you cannot locate space, you cannot find the mind. It has no inherent existence. If it had inherent existence, then it would have to be in some form. And if it had form, it would also have color, shape, or size. But the mind has no color, shape, or size. Mind has no root, no place, no base, no sign, no color, no shape, and it is beyond perception. It has no center and it has no edges. Ordinary people do not ever bother to wonder about the nature of reality, but more intelligent people ask themselves, why are we here? And what is the nature of things? And they wonder if what we ordinarily see differs from the true nature of reality. Our defilements and our illusions create the appearance of these samsaric things, but reality is something different. Some thoughtful people try to find out what reality is, and the ultimate or the primary answer that the Buddha taught is called the perfection of wisdom. And then later on, it was further expounded by Nagarjuna as the philosophy of the middle way school. Nagarjuna explained all phenomena in two ways, the relative truth and the absolute truth. Relative truth takes reality to be as it appears in an unexamined way. Relatively speaking, there is a self, there are things, there are beings, there is experience, and so on. But after examining this with a very sharp reasoning, he found that, at the absolute level, it's impossible to say conclusively that reality is like this or like that. His Eminence Jogyi Tuchin Rinpoche said, according to the mind-only school of Buddhist teaching, while on the one hand it is true that this world is not created by any supreme being or by anyone else, on the other hand it is also true that everything is fabricated by one's own state of mind. All appearances are mind. Nothing exists outside of the mind's sphere of experience. Mind is the substratum that creates and projects all phenomena. As it is within, so it is without. This is where the Buddha offers us an alternative to conventional viewpoints, stating that nothing is created by anything other than one's own mind, afflicted by karma and defilements. The Buddha himself has made it clear and demonstrated at great length that there isn't any supreme being that creates anything at all. Hence, because the conventionally held beliefs are neither logical nor, in fact, true, what is the point in entertaining these inaccurate views of reality, imagining phenomena to be created by something other than one's own mind? Similarly, in regard to the materialist view, we need to ascertain that neither the physical world nor our subtle physical body is created from intrinsically existing elements. Whatever may appear to us is none other than our mind, manifesting the entire spectrum of forms we perceive. These forms are distorted appearances of the mind itself, which only seem to exist independently of, or external to, oneself. If all the phenomena we perceive are actually our own minds, then it must be our own thoughts that construct our experience. In the end, whatever we experience is not dictated or determined by the appearances around us, as is commonly believed. Whether one is attracted by something or repulsed by it, these are only sentiments projected by the mind into the apparent object. It is the one who is experiencing appearances, the mind, that actually determines what appears to us, as well as determining how we will experience it. Things do not exist in reality. When the mind is ignorant of its creative power, and so is unable to understand that all creation has its origin within the mind itself, it will often claim that a god or something else has the power to create the things it is experiencing. Alternately, such an ignorant mind may assert that everything is the creation of material elements, of the compounding of different elements together. These are eternalist views. In this way, those who are blind to the mind's inherent creativity will always attribute responsibility for their own experiences and perceptions to something outside of themselves. Whatever they may perceive, everything, whether tangible or intangible, will be seen as external to or other than themselves. In the same way, what is the point of wearing oneself out by seeking the causes of creation externally or seeking some other creator and so wasting valuable time? Instead, to begin, you should look within and withdraw your mind from its engagement with all these apparent external phenomena. As the mind ceases to focus on an outside world, you can discover that the world that you have been so involved with has actually been outwardly projected by this very mind. As the mind withdraws its projections and beliefs, the world will cease to manifest in the way that it has. This is so because it is only mind that is manifesting the world around us. This tells us that if we are experiencing happiness, this is the result of wholesome thought that we have given rise to in the past. There is no doubt that happy experiences are the manifest expression of virtuous thoughts. These are what create happiness. If we are experiencing unhappiness, it's because our previous unwholesome thoughts have ripened into our present experience of suffering. One who discovers the key point that mind is the cause of all problems and all solutions learns to unlock, to disentangle all things associated with the mind, and in the end, one finds no other culprit. Mind is the perpetrator of everything that happens, the projector of everything that manifests. Pleasant or unpleasant, whether we go up in higher rebirth or down to the lower rebirths, whatever we experience is the result of our own mental state. Realizing this, we should no longer grasp at any perception or conception that might arise towards seemingly real phenomena. Buddha himself stated in the sutras that all things are only mind. And through realizing this, you will be able to enter and remain in the meditative equipoise of the true nature of mind. If all things are mind, we must look into the nature of this mind, and rather than falling into such extremes as eternalism or nihilism, being or non-being, we should uphold and sustain the genuine view of the true nature of mind. This truth is emphasized by the teachings of the mind-only school of Buddhism, which states that all things are only mind. Does this mean we can leave the matter with the conclusion that all things are nothing but mind? In fact, this is not sufficient. Thus, we are directed to the viewpoint of the Madhyamaka or Middle Way school. However, unless you correctly establish at the outset that all things are mind only, you will have no basis upon which to ascertain anything further. Once you have really established that everything you are experiencing is your own mind, then it becomes possible to further discern the reality of emptiness. And thus the knowledge that all is mind is a stepping stone on the way to complete understanding. The view of mind only is not the final truth of the Sakya school. It is only a stage that leads on to the enlightened view. And while we have mentioned the importance of calm abiding meditation, what we are really concerned with here is to be able to recognize the true nature of mind. Let us consider this in terms of the dawning of clear insight in meditation practice. On the subject of how insight unfolds through the process of meditation, there are in the Buddhist tradition a number of approaches. There are a number of commentaries on this point, which have been given by many great teachers. In general, a majority of teachers have preferred to rely on the gradual method of progressive insight as the means of guiding their students. In this approach, one progressively discovers and comes to experience all as mind. And then next, all that appears in the mind is found to be illusory. And third, one is then able to understand that these illusory phenomena come about through dependent origination. And finally, the nature of dependent origination is realized to be inexpressible. It is to help ensure a clearer realization of insight that so many teachers have chosen to guide students through these four stages of understanding. Why, if it is true that all is mind, do appearances assume the forms they do? Why do they not assume the forms and conditions we would prefer to choose for them? It's out of this line of questioning that the next essential insight evolves, namely, that all these mind-created appearances are illusions that come about through causes and conditions. With this basis, or preliminary step of learning to rest your mind in the meditation of calm abiding, from this state you enter the meditation of clear insight. Once we have discovered that everything that appears to us is mind, then we can begin to examine the mind for ourselves in our meditation practice. We discover that it is really an illusion. Left unexamined, everything seems real enough, but upon closer scrutiny, as we will see, whatever appears doesn't really exist. These illusions or mind displays come about through causes and conditions, through dependent origination, and so do not exist on their own, in their own right. In order to understand our ordinary dualistic mind, one example often used is that of a dream. One may dream of being a king and wielding great power over others, but this only happens in the dream, not reality. Just like the nature of the dream, whatever occurs in the mind appears to the mind is illusory. In a dream, whether we become wealthy or poor or whatever we experience, we only seem to go through these experiences because we are afflicted by sleep, and it is only sleep that makes it seem as though they are really happening. We need to meditate well on the example of the dream. A person afflicted by sleep undergoes dreams that seem to be real, although they are not. It's no different with our present waking experience, afflicted as we are by the sleep of ignorance. Through the analogy of sleep and dream, we can understand that the only reason we perceive and experience things the way we do is that we are deluded by ignorance. It's due to ignorance that we are unable to perceive things as they really are, and due to ignorance, our mental and emotional defilements act in conjunction with our accumulated karmic deeds, creating the distorted vision we hold at present regarding ourselves and our world. Thus, all waking experiences in everyday life are distorted by our karma and obscurations. Everything is a reflection of mind or consciousness. Nothing whatsoever exists other than what appears to the mind due to karma and due to the defilements, the concepts, and the afflictive emotions. Our karma and defilements create a background upon which our waking life manifests, just as the condition of sleep provides a backdrop for dreams. Without these, we would not experience things in the way we currently do. Just as When sleeping, we perceive dreams as real, so, too, in ignorance, we perceive whatever we experience as being real, though it is no more real than a dream. Just as the affliction of sleep causes dreams to seem real to us, so does the affliction of ignorance, our defilements and obscurations, cause our waking life to seem real to us. Just as the condition of sleep makes our nighttime dreams seem real to us, so do our conventional designations and concepts seem to validate our daytime waking experience. And yet, the great tantric text of the Vajrapanjara states that nothing in samsara or nirvana exists outside of mind itself. Through inquiring into these examples and analogies in our meditation practice, we can come to realize that our waking life has no more valid existence than our dream life. As soon as one awakens from the dream, there is no tangible trace of the events one was experiencing just moments before. Nothing that seemed to occur in the dream actually took place. It is exactly the same with all of our daytime waking experiences, which are in the same way unreal. Although everything may seem quite normal and valid as far as we are concerned, this is only because we have not yet awakened from the dreamlike slumber of ignorance. And until such time as we wake up, we will continue to experience all these illusory phenomena without knowing that none of these really exist. These are some of the ways in which understanding develops. Through insight gained in meditation, we can discover that all of our day-to-day experiences are manifested by our karmic propensities or tendencies. They are the manifestation of our karma, our previous deeds, and of our defilements, our negativities. There is nothing inherently real about our perceptions. The sum of our experience is nothing more than our own minds manifesting the distorted vision of conditioned existence. And when you finally understand that all experience and all appearances are mind only, as has been stated by the Buddha, then this means that your experiences do not really exist, that none of this is real. This is what we must realize through our own meditation practice. In coming to understand this, why wouldn't we then just allow the mind simply to be as it is? In this way, you become able to withdraw from being constantly conditioned by illusory experience and can instead simply allow the mind to rest in supreme peace. This means that you come to rest in true nature of mind itself. The view of the Madhyamaka school asserts that mind has no inherent existence. It accepts that how things appear to the mind is the result of many conditions, without there being any inherently existing mind to which things appear. Without discerning the truth about the mind, one will not be able to unravel the many questions and conundrums necessary to fully understand the nature of things. This is how it is laid out in the teachings of the path, including the result, in the Heivajra tradition, where the view is not left simply at saying that everything is mind. Rather, if everything is mind, then all these mental appearances are in fact illusory, since they are only being created by our minds through the interdependence of different causes and conditions. And if you are able to realize this through the practice of meditation, then it is possible to unravel all of your confusion regarding the nature of reality. This produces great benefits. Through realizing this, you will be able to dissolve manifest appearances easily, since once the mind deeply accepts the truth, it is able to put a stop to all projections. Instead, one's mind takes full responsibility knowing that it, the mind, is the creator. If one's mind is the creator of all that it experiences, one's mind is also responsible for all the illusions it creates. And through this knowledge, our minds can become independent, unconditioned, uninfluenced by the illusory nature that we had previously perceived as reality. In truth, the one who has been conditioned by all these mental illusions is the one who has been watching them. In reality, this one is the observer of an illusory magical display. So that's one section that His Eminence talked about. And now we're going to go to another section here, which is pre-recorded. Without the presence of causes and conditions, a magical illusion cannot manifest. Similarly, it is only due to specific circumstances that all things appear to exist. In fact, there is nothing even the size of a sesame seed that truly exists. As everything depends on causes and conditions, it is through understanding causes and conditions that we are able to deconstruct appearances. This is how we come to find out for ourselves that things do not actually exist. All phenomena are merely conditional. They are the result of dependent origination, of interdependent conditions, just like in a magician's illusion. If all mentally generated appearances are no different from those conjured by an illusionist, then all these appearances are also no more real than a conjurer's illusions, no matter how convinced we may be of their validity. We need to know appearances to be illusory, creations of our minds, in order to understand that what we perceive and experience is not real. How can we be so sure that these illusionist tricks of the mind do not really exist? By definition, an illusion is something that does not exist. It only seems to be due to a variety of composite factors, causes and conditions, the interdependence of which produces illusory scenarios that present themselves to our experience. When the conditions meet, the illusory situation manifests. Without the many causes and conditions that create appearances, there is not a single existing phenomenon to be found anywhere. Meditating deeply on the example of a magic show can bring about definite insight into the unreality of our present vision of things. Thus, we have established that it is a combination of factors that are compounded to produce the appearances we currently experience. For example, we have our sense organs, the sense objects, the concepts and designations we hold in mind, and so on. When these compounded factors interact with one another interdependently, phenomena are produced through dependent origination. Although they are no more than phantoms, they manifest, but only temporarily due to causes and conditions. This will continue to be the case until we are able to realize that they are dreamlike illusions, phantom appearances. Magical illusions arise from various factors. Perhaps the most central of these is the spectator, who is willing to be spellbound. What this means is that one must be able to withdraw from being spellbound or fascinated by the illusory creations of one's mind. Then one will become independent from, no longer identified with, these illusory experiences. If we are able to realize appearances as illusory, we will cease to grasp and fixate upon them as though they were real. This is the key point. To summarize what we have understood so far, all things are only mind, and mind itself is illusory. All these reflections of the mind do not exist. Their very nature is illusory. These illusory appearances do not exist in themselves independently, but rather they simply come about as the product of many different causes and conditions through interdependence. These illusory experiences depend on causes and conditions, distinct components that together constitute and manifest what we perceived as our reality. This is the meaning of the example of the conjurer, one who can manipulate various conditions in order to delude his audience into believing that something that is not really there. Through meditation on these analogies and the truths they illustrate, one will be able to realize the law of dependent origination. Phenomena are so dependent on factors other than themselves that nothing happens on its own, and nothing functions independently. We should continue to remind ourselves of the four stages we have been discussing. All appearances are nothing but mind. Appearances do not exist inherently, but are like illusions. The fact that illusory appearances can manifest is due to dependent origination. And finally, there are no words that can express the real nature of appearances, as they are ineffable. This is how the realization of clear insight evolves gradually out of calm abiding meditation. As meditation progresses, we begin to understand and then to realize the meaning of the view. Anything that is dependent on factors other than itself does not inherently of itself exist. Therefore, it is illusory, as the nature of illusions is that they do not inherently exist of themselves. As they lack inherent existence, not existing in their own right, this necessarily means that they depend on factors other than themselves. Things appear, but not because they are. Things appear because they are not. In summary, first we have explained how to discern the proper form of ethical conduct, study, contemplation, and meditation, as well as how to distinguish between authentic and artificial morality, study, contemplation, and meditation. And secondly, we have explained how to follow a more genuine form of renunciation while discarding shallow pursuits. Third, we have shown the necessity of dedicating oneself to the precious bodhicitta, the most prized and genuine form of altruism for the sake of all sentient beings. We have discussed how to generate bodhicitta on the basis of true love and compassion for others. And fourthly, in relation to the correct view of emptiness, we have explained how, in order to realize the middle way, the true nature of mind, it is essential for us not to fall into any extreme or polarized position as represented by the two extreme viewpoints. We now dedicate the merit of this activity for the benefit of all sentient beings. So that's the end of the fourth line. Any questions about this topic?
I wonder about clairvoyant dreams, because sometimes they become reality for, you know what I mean? Like, how does that happen if you're dreaming and it becomes real, but then it's still an illusion?
Yeah, well, what I've heard teachers say is that there are different kinds of dreams. So what we're talking about here is just the regular dream that we have that may or may not have some relevance to your waking life, but it's just a regular dream. But then there are other kinds of dreams which are clairvoyant or prophetic or intuitive or in some way in a different category, I suppose. And in fact, really high lamas use dream practice. There is, you know, actual dream yoga practice, and they really high lamas use it all the time. You know, these reincarnations that are discovered and recognized by these high lamas are very often discovered in dreams. So for people like that, at that level, there's a different kind of a dream category. Or if somebody's gifted with clairvoyance or some sort of, you know, ability of some sort, that's a different kind of dream than what we're talking about here. So that's what I've heard other teachers say about that.
All right.
It's an interesting question, though, especially if you've had a dream like that. It makes you wonder. Yeah. Dream about getting a letter and then the letter arrives or something like that. Even something really small like that, it makes you wonder, doesn't it? I think, you know, a mind that has that ability is not tied down to the conventional discussion that we had this evening about being attached and all that. That's my take on it anyway. Any other questions? So this includes the fourth line of the Parting from the Four Attachments. Next week, as I said earlier, there'll be a kind of a special class with a different perspective on the Four Attachments from another commentator, Gorampa Sonam Senge. So there's lots of food for thought in this kind of discussion. But really, the realization has to come from meditation. All of this is the discursive side of the coin. However, it's really good to have a meditation guide when we're getting these types of meditations because, of course, deep topic, easy to go astray. Don't want to do that. Want to make sure you're on track with this one because it's, of course, very important. So so we won't do a guided meditation this evening. If there aren't any more questions, we can say the dedication prayers. So nam de dom je zigpa ni dom na ni pe da nam pam je te ke ga na ji ba lung tu pe Sidpe tso le do wa du or shu Jang chu zem jo rim po chi Ma ke pa nam ke gyur chi Ke ma nyam par me par yang Gong ne gong tu pel par shu Jam pa pa oi ji tar ken ba dang Kun du sang po de yang de shin te De da kung gi je su da lo chir Ge wa di dak tam che ra tu no Su je bi gya wa tan che ki No wa gang la cho tu nga pa gi Da jen ge we ca wa di kung kyung Sang po cho che rab tu ngo Chag sa wa dang cho ching sa pa dang Jesu yi rang gu shing so wa yi Ge wa chung ze da gi chi sak pa Tam che zo pe jang chu chi By the Spirit, may obtain omniscience, may it defeat the enemy of wrongdoing, from the stormy waves of birth, old age, sickness, and death, from the ocean of samsara, may all beings be free. Bodhicitta is precious, may it arise in all beings in whom it has not arisen, may it never decline where it has arisen, but may it ever grow and flourish. Whatever way my own volume of Sri and Samantabhadra know how to transfer merit, so do I dedicate all my own virtues that I may train to be like them. Through this dedication, praise is supreme by the victorious Buddhas of the past, present, and future. I, together with all sentient beings, dedicate these roots of virtue to attaining Buddhahood. By whatever virtue I may have gained from prostrating, offering, confessing, rejoicing, requesting, and beseeching, be dedicated to attaining perfect enlightenment. Thank you.
Thank you, Michael.